Hey everyone, welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. Breaking tradition here because one, we've got a great podcast with Lieutenant Colonel Justin Elliott, call sign boss. He was the commanding officer of the Air Force Thunderbirds, which is the demonstration team for America, F-16 jets. And I was humbled enough and honored to do a backseat ride with Justin and his team, in which I passed out twice and got over 9 Gs. So I'm in the 9G club. But the sound quality on this one is not good because it was an air show. But Justin is one of those leaders that you meet, and I thought this was worth pushing out regardless of the audio, that you just question. You're like, no one can be this good. Nobody can be this disciplined. Nobody can live this true to what they preach in their character, and that would be wrong. This is Justin. Justin is exactly what he preaches. He follows through on it, and he is a role model of what our military leaders look like. And what he's about to share is he spits gold. For any leader listening, you've got to listen to this. I guarantee you're going to take 1 to 3 lessons learned, and you can definitely implement them in your life. Before we get to it, just a reminder, go to Amazon, check out The Everyday Warrior, a no-hack practical approach to life. It is the book I wrote. It is the foundation of The Everyday Warrior podcast. We've gotten rave reviews. People said they've read it 2-3 times, and that it's one of the biggest self-leadership, I know we call it self-help, self-leadership books that they've ever read. And I'm honored to have pushed it out, humbled to have pushed it out. And it's not about me. It's about the high performers I served with in the SEAL teams and watching their daily habits and their routines and how they live their lives. And it's a testament to them. All right, guys, let's get to it. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I am thrilled because I've just come off one of the most unique and unforgettable days of my life. I got to do a backseat ride in a F-16 with none other than the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds, which are the very best fighter pilots in the world. And that doesn't take anything away from the Blue Angels or anyone else. They fall into those ranks as well. So, Justin, thanks for joining me, man. Congrats on the elements that you've built. I mean, I needed this. 5 years retired, I've forgotten how good the U.S. military is. I know you guys fall into probably one of the most high-performing elements in the U.S. military. But from your customer service to execution over the beach of Huntington for the air show, everything just has been, I would describe it as excellence. It's the epitome of excellence.
That is absolutely our objective, is to portray that beacon of excellence for the minimum service in everything we do across 30 different job types and how everybody would be.
Okay, so I'm a people watcher. That sounds very odd. Not in a creepy way. I've been watching you. I'm fascinated with leadership. I'm fascinated with leadership development. I'm fascinated with culture and how you meld all those together to create high-performing teams that stand apart. Briefly, before we get into leadership, just want to get your backstory. I know Houston, Texas, right from, I'd love to say I'm a Texan. I say it from Frisco, Texas, San Francisco. But give us your backstory, because you ended up in Yale. Did you know you wanted Air Force?
No, I did not. What I knew is that I wanted to go to space and I wanted to fly fighter jets. And so as I grew up in Houston, both of my parents immigrated to the country. So I was a first generation American. I was born in Florida, moved to Texas, grew up in Texas. Had no idea how to join the U.S. military or even if that was a real option. I'd seen Top Gun. I knew that fighter pilots were the things I saw on TV. I mean, the astronauts went to space. They both sounded amazing, but it didn't seem like a dream that was realistically achievable. And I was very fortunate to have NASA in my backyard growing up in Houston. And when I started looking into the backgrounds of the astronauts, I found that most of them were either Air Force test pilots or Navy test pilots that were flying shuttle at the time. And so I went after them. And instead of going to the Air Force Academy, I was recruited to swim at Yale University. So I wanted to go there, but we couldn't afford it. There was no way that my family was going to be able to afford a school that expensive. Fortunately, the ROTC program for the Air Force stayed full course. I literally 100% room and board and everything. I couldn't believe the program existed. At the time, I thought that 4 years of payback for 4 years of university life was too high. It was a crazy time, right?
It was so
much time. Now I'm looking back just over 19 years of your career and wanted to do 20 more. Thinking, gosh, it's incredible that the Air Force pays for your entire university experience with a civilian school. So I chased that dream in the Air Force, and I've been very, very happy. What made me join the Air Force was chasing the space trap. What's made me stay is the experiences I've had. And as I've grown up, then I've found that the leadership experiences, the command experiences, that second career that you get after being fighter pilot, right, those are the ones that really hooked me. And it made me want to stick around for a very long time.
Those dreams, those aspirations of space, are they still there?
They're still there. Kind of a crazy story. I was an astronaut finalist in 2017. 4 years later, the board came up in 2021, and I was going down the same path again. I did not expect to be picked for this job. I just wrapped up a squadron command at Nellis, and that has a very fulfilling squadron, 59th Test and Evaluation Squadron, all six fighters under one roof. It was the Dream Command, so we had F-35s, F-22s, A-10s, stuff. And I thought I was done with command. I thought I was ready to move on to space if selected to do so. And when I got picked by our four-star general in Air Combat Contingency Firebird 1, believe it or not, it happened on the flight line.
Yeah.
Our four-star's name is Mark Kelly, General Mark Kelly.
Yes.
The other Mark Kelly on the flight line, no kidding, was astronaut Mark Kelly, now Senator Mark Kelly.
Yeah.
And I was giving a tour to both of them about the F-35 versus the A-10. And that was when General Mark Kelly told me I was Thunderbird 1. And I don't know why to this day, but I knew what I had to do. And I had to stop that NASA dream for a minute and do the show.
Wow, that's patience. That's patience. So you still feel like you owe the Air Force?
Absolutely. I absolutely feel that way. The Air Force has given me too much. And it's thrown me up a lot from college to now. They let me go to fighter weapons school, which is the elite flying course for fighter aviation, very similar to Top Gun in the Navy. And then when I thought that was the best thing that the Air Force had ever given me, they let me go to test pilot school as well. And I became an experimental test pilot and got to fly 33 different airplanes and put 3,000 hours on between experimental flight tests and traditional combat testing. And thought, okay, that they can't get better. It can't get better. I owe these guys something back. And then they gave me Thunderbird 1. And thank you.
I speak
to book. To say I'm humble is it's not sufficient. The fact that the Air Force has let me do this many amazing things in my career is amazing. And I do feel like I know the Air Force.
And the taxpayers. I'm joking.
No, it's true.
I'm glad that you guys get to do what you do. And that is a bill worth from. So you are about to finish up your second command tour, and for everyone, that means, you know, the test and evaluation squadron, how many total personnel under that?
It's about 200 when you include all the civilians.
Yes. And the Thunderbirds are about 135. So leading that many people is a challenge. That's not easy, especially E-type personalities, which, let's be honest, pilots, much like SEALs, are E-type personalities. Where did you refine your leadership? Because I know, probably Yale, Air Force ROTC, but you probably served for some amazing leaders who have shaped you into the leader that you are. I know, of course, we have your parents to thank for the integrity and the character that built you. But what's that one leader that stands out that sort of shaped you in the early days of the Air Force?
I've had some incredible leaders that have shaped me. My very first fighter squadron. My very first fighter squadron was the 335th Fighter Squadron in Seymour Johnson. We were flying F-15s. It was called the Chiefs. Incredible fighter squadron.
Strike Eagles, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly. It was Colonel Gipper Bunch at the time. He ended up retiring as a general. I remember him walking into one of our very first commander's call, and he took command of the squadron. And there's a couple of things about Dipper. I got to give you just a couple of stories about how shaping he was for me, and probably for this man sitting up. I remember him standing up at his first commander call and saying, "This is a meritocracy. your performance matters. Your results at the end of this assignment depend on your performance and how well you do. And that really spoke to me. You know, I think a lot of people assume that that you can just coast, right? That once you've got your job and you're established and you're now in our case, we were all F-15E fighter pilots at the time. So we just made it through quite a crucible of training to get to that point. And just remember to have the commander stand up there and say, I'm watching and your performance matters because this is combat that we're about to go do. And this squadron is in there. It's obvious somebody. It fired me. Now, I think it did that for what ended up becoming, it's got to be the highest performing fighter squadron in a given era at the time. And the Chiefs just thrived in their leadership. I think it's because we were all okay with competition. And it was openly acknowledged that this is competition and go get better, make each other better. He lived it too. All right. He would come in and lead flights as the squadron commander. Squadron commander is very busy. Very, very busy. Yes. Squadron commander lead flights. It's broadly speaking, a lot of office time, a lot of management, a lot of kind of high-level strategy, looking at what's next on the horizon, you know, through the periscope, and then jumping into sorties to stay in touch with what goes on in the squadron. But very rarely do you see that kind of upfront leadership, and he would show up for it, and he would be good.
That was going to be a quick, the old man out of zone.
Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't help but notice. You know, he would bring his experiences to the brief and debrief, and you were like, hey, tips. This guy's meeting and flying. Yeah. That's someone to look up to. And I've never forgot.
Technically, definitely proficient and complete. That's amazing. So you came in right at the height of the war.
Yeah.
Obviously, so right around 2004, 2005?
I did. Yeah, I joined the Air Force in 2005. That was when I commissioned out of college.
And then right into Iraq tours, Afghanistan?
Yeah. So the 335th was on the rotation through Operation Enduring Freedom at Barton Air Force Base. Before the F-16s took over, it was an F-15 base up in the north, the Barton.
Yes.
The 10th out of the south.
Okay. So right during the height of everything.
It was pretty sporty.
As we like to say. The Thunderbirds, explain that mission for Americans. I think for most people, they're just, you know, demonstration pilots, but that it's actually America's sort of demonstration team.
That's exactly right. And you couldn't have said it better. So you got to understand the background of demonstration in the United States to really grasp what the Thunderbird mission is. And to do that, you got to go back before 1953. The first demonstration squadron in America was the Luanas in 1946. And they were founded with a very, very specific purpose that the Air Force was about to happen in 1947. Navy was afraid of losing the aviation. So they make the Blue Angels, and if you look at them, it's blue and gold, right? Giant U.S. Navy letters across the bottom of the wings. And still to this day, that paint scheme has stayed because the Navy was saying, hey, we have an aviation wing. Do not give this to the Air Force or whatever you're going to create here with this new DOD. Just leave us alone. You know, we're the Navy, and we can fly too, and they're very good at it. And so the Blue Angels were founded first, and they're exceptional. 1953, a little bit of a different problem. We're smack in the middle of the Korean War. You're in an era where institutional trust is challenged between the American population and its governing body. And so when the Thunderbirds were commissioned, very intentionally, not painted blue as well, not painted Air Force colors. They do say Air Force on them, but it's small, if you notice. And it's because you're attacking a different problem. The Air Force didn't have a recruiting problem. The Thunderbirds were never really founded with the intention of recruiting. They were aimed at inspiration, and specifically to connect the American population to its military in the most divided of times, which is why they're red, white, blue. They're trying to create America's demonstrations. We've been doing that for 70 years ever since.
70 years.
70 years.
So you guys have a motto called Blind Trust. And I think 5 years removed from the military, I sort of step back now that I've operated in the private sector business world. That's rare.
Yes.
In the business world. Yeah. And it made me think back, wow, the concept of blind trust. Now, if I remember, yeah, I had blind trust in my guys that they knew the mission, they knew the commander's desired outcomes or commander's intent, that let them run. Even if they're off on their own, you go get the mission done. No, having clear guidance. explain that for us civilians, for these business leaders that are watching the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast, and we've got a lot, how that concept is achieved, what it means and how that's achieved through leadership.
Two different things there, too. What it means is that we have to, absolutely have to trust that the person sitting right next to us, in some cases, literally 18 inches away, going 600 miles an hour, have the way to do their jobs to perfection, releasing the ability where it stays safe. We have to have blind trust. In fact, it's written on every door I swore. And here's a bit of trivia. My speed brakes, which you probably saw today, the back of that S60 right next to the engine, when those speed brakes open, it says blind trust across the speed brakes.
You have to give me photos of this.
And, yeah. And number four, on the, for example, the Bremer 360, or for our slot kickover on our takeoff, or for our rapid recovery, is literally looking at blind trust sitting right in her face with the speed brakes open, with my afterburner lit, blasting right on top of her can. It's a moment where if you're ever going to understand why blind trust is important, you know, that would be it right there. When you're trusting those speed brakes and that burner to hold the forces together in that diamond to keep it safe. The blind trust, though, it's not just about the blind. It's everything we do. Every person on our team has two jobs. Every person on our team is responsible for their primary job and then also an additional duty. It's the only way we can make this enormous operation happen with as few people as we have. And it comes down to every single thing we do. So when I step to a jet to make a show-worthy watch where people are watching me with, you know, I think I told you earlier, we are trying to present the image of impossible, human achievement at the level of the cosmic. And so to do that, when we start up our F-16s, I've got about 100 checklist items going at the same time, but you won't see my head move. Like, I will stare straight through the during those show watches in front of the crowd. Every switch behind me is happening behind my back. It's a completely blind cockpit test. I'm typing in coordinates. I'm doing things without looking at it. And I'm able to do that because the crew chief that sets up my jet, I have blind trust that those switches are going to be perfectly checked. There are things that can happen on those launches. If I've got a switch error where I could start up and spill poison exploded on our crew chiefs below us, or even the crowd. So the level of trust is that high that I know that I can do that blind and still know that it's going to be a safe operation. And that goes throughout the entire team. Now, you ask how we do that. Some of it's selection. You know, I've got 689,000 people serving the Air Force right now. We get to pick the 135 that best represent not just the Air Force, but the nation as a whole across 30 different jet types. So I do get to pick the very finest people to be a part of the team. There is a lot more to it than that. There have been teams that didn't perform as well. So just picking great people, it doesn't do it for you. I think as a leader, blind trust is important because ultimately, it's important as a leader to conclude that you need them more than they need you. You could replace me tomorrow. The squadron will function just fine. When you start to degrade, create factions, break people apart, break that trust down, when you start to show a lack of faith in these individual elements of the team, it will fall apart in a way that you will never get it. And I think it's critical to convey that you trust them. Because I think that frees them to enhance their performance and sparkers. So I've been privileged over the last few years to have just torrents of great ideas thrown at them. Almost all of which I've said yes to. There's a yes, because they were truly great ideas. I think I can take that back to the check-in. When everyone checks in the score, and I tell them exactly that, don't break the tech orders. It's not where they're wrong. You know, show me how we can do this mission better, because at the end of the day, we are a living example of agile combat. We are deployed to two different cities every week. We have no Air Force support structure. We've got nothing that we can just reach out to grab a spare part. So one of my guys are going down to blacksmith shop. We call it the blacksmiths, but like auto parts shops downtown, and find ways to build jet parts out of what they have. And doing things that we're going to need in combat. Okay, these are skills that we're going to need. And that's really what it all comes down to. So it's me being able to convey accurately to my team members, I do trust you. love it. I'm going to back you up. And if you make a mistake, that's okay. We're going to work through it together, and we're going to find a way to build a better process off of that mistake. We're not going to get ostracized.
Man,
I'm motivated. I am motivated by listening to you. This is awesome. And we need more of this within our nation. We just do. Really starting with our youth. Always the next best generation. On that topic, leadership development. You've got junior pilots to you. Hence your call sign boss. How do you go about making sure that they're that much better when they take your number one slot?
Yeah.
8-12 years from now.
Yeah. It starts with conveying the mentality you're right up front, and I mean in selection. Before we even have them join the team, our interview process is two different sets of full weeks. One of which they get to see us on the road in that deployed environment, and the desired objective there is your shock. Okay, I know you thought you were just six pilots at fly air shows, but watch this. You'll never see the same thing twice. You'll never see an environment with more contingencies than an air show environment where the weather changes, configuration changes, and life flight flies through the TFR in the middle of emergency. You know, that shock, I think that's important to just say, like, okay, look, this is hard. And then the second week, that's the critical one, because we bring them back to Nellis Air Force Base where they see what life is like at home. And they see that at home, well, that's not a break either. Now we're flying twice every day. We don't have weekends. Very, very busy. And we do it because we care that much. And so in that interview process, we were just talking about this the other day, actually. I was kind of like missing out because the new team members are here right now. And we were talking about my intro speech to them at Dallas, where I basically tell them, all right, this is the hardest thing you're going to do in your life. This is the most intense and stressful thing you're going to do in your life if you join this team. And probably no one's even going to recognize it for it. You know, probably you're just a uniform, and individually, you pour yourself into this brand, you'll build it, and then you walk away, and no one will ever know you do. And if they jump up and say, yep, that's me, you know, I want to do the hardest thing I've ever done and the most intense thing I've ever done and be stressed out, and I'm going to do it for no personal recognition, well, then that's the person I want. And if we can build a team of people with that mentality, the people that pour themselves into this brand, instead of the ones that siphon this brand out to build a personal unit and then walk out of the Air Force, then this team will be amazing. It is, at the end of the day, a service-oriented team. And so we set that mentality right up front with everyone that checks in, everyone that puts this patch on. Here's that. Not just hears it, but has to live it, has to feel it through the application process. And then only once they're on the team do we start showing them, okay, I know you thought it was hard, but guess what's hard. And we set that standard up front, and we continue to press forward with that ultimate demand of, like, give, and leave it all to. And if you walk off this team successfully, you make it through 2 years, I know you're going to be an outstanding leader when you get out of there, because you've learned the service side. You've learned that the rewards are in what you give, not what you take.
Yes.
And it is impossible to graduate this team right now the way that we are operating without learning that lesson. Because you don't take anything. I say it all the time in the posturing meetings before we head out to different show sites. Like, remember, we're giving to, not a taking to. And I want you to be all you can eat buffets in free grass. I want you talking to kids. Yeah, I want us to hurt if necessary with what we will absorb. You know, from the, everybody's busy at ours. The air boss is busy, the airfield's busy, towers, everybody's busy. I want us to absorb what we can because we're well trained and we can do that. So that the experience of the American population there is that, wow, what a great time I've had at Breeder Ashes with the Air Force and the Fair Skill Center. Our government's awesome.
It is. Ben, there was a junior Air Force Army to see you the other night.
Yes.
Probably about 40 kids. They were looking at you guys like you were their absolute heroes. And you used to be one of those kids. I mean, do you ever look back on that and think, man, high school I went into, you didn't even think this was probably possible?
I didn't think it was possible. I honestly didn't think it was possible. I thought this was TV stuff. And it was, yeah, I thought it was, find something else. It was your name, Engine. And that to be able to take care of this team for a little bit. Those kids that you saw us meet with today, they're my heroes. Because they're signing up for something bigger than this.
Damn right.
And it's a tough environment. The pandemic split us up quite a bit. One of the most divided times, at least I've seen in my lifetime. At least you're well enough to know we've been close before. 1979, Crest of Confidence for Jimmy Carter. And that speech really resonates. And you don't think you guys watch it and hear it today. Thankfully, Tall Giant, the USSR, just came out of a war that wasn't popular. You like it today, 10 foot tall giant with a chunk where you just stand out of a little bit of time. You've been here. You thought it was you've been here, so you're like cultural waves for decades. And to be able to be a part of it in a time like this is really special. Yeah, have it in stunning for the Italian American population. You know, it's like what you know, it's actually there to this train. Just listen, we got you. Okay. Well, you're us.
You know, every generation probably thinks that America's at its lowest. I guarantee probably the Vietnam generation thought the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
We really endure. And what I love, and this is not me blowing smoke whatsoever, is that you guys are like a single candle that can light 1,000 candles. Mm-hmm. And that goes a long way. I can't thank you enough for joining us. I can't thank you enough for allowing me to be part of your team for one day. And for Sibber to give me that ride, and I guess I'm in the 9G club now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, that's not a good club either.
No, I'll take it. No, very, very grateful, especially on a very special day for me where I've lost one of my guys on September 29th. So for that, for your entire nation, thank you for being the character leader that you are and setting the example for the rest of us to follow, whether we're Randy or Eagle Father.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your service. Thank you very much. You've given me a contribution. Thank you. Exactly. No, I sincerely mean it. So thank you for continuing to highlight teams like this. We really do care about SEU. It's your place like you that lost it.
Thanks, man.